Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 153, entitled, How One Man Infiltrated the Hell's Angels Motorcycle Gang and Lived to Tell His Story, I chat with Jay Dobbins. Jay Dobbins is a New York Times bestselling author and retired special agent and veteran undercover operative with the ATF. In today's episode, Jay talks about his heart-pounding memories inside the infamous and deadly Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club. Jay talks about how he infiltrated this well-organized criminal enterprise for 2 full years and how his work was able to lead to 16 indictments of the gang's members. He dives into the mindset, skills, and training he needed to survive inside the Hell's Angels operation and the insane experiences he had while being an undercover member. If you're wondering what the Hell's Angels motorcycle gang is really like and how one man was able to infiltrate this elusive and deadly organization, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Hey, if you haven't signed up for the Elite Man newsletter yet, go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. This is an incredible newsletter which helps you become the best man you can be. Every single week, we give you the best tips, strategies, and techniques for helping you master your personal, social, and business life and give you exclusive content not seen nor heard on the podcast or anywhere else. That's elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. Sign up right now. And now, a word from our fantastic Elite Man podcast sponsors. Hey, 2018 just started and it's the perfect time to get both your health and finances in order. If you're a health conscious individual like myself, then you know just how awesome it is to know you're taking charge of your health and well-being. Now it's time to get rewarded for being health-minded and fit. I've talked about Health IQ on the podcast before, but now's the perfect time to take advantage of this incredible life insurance company. Health IQ is the fastest growing life insurance company in the world. 56% of Health IQ customers save up to 33% on their life insurance. One Health IQ customer was able to cut his yearly premium by around 80% while increasing his coverage. Another man was able to find a great plan that was $100 cheaper per month than the one he was paying before. How does Health IQ deliver such fantastic results? Simple. They use science and data and, unlike so many other life insurance companies, actually reward you for being healthy. Do yourself and your family a huge favor and check out Health IQ. To see if you qualify for an incredible savings of up to 33%, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/eliteman or mention the promo code ELITEMAN when you talk to a Health IQ agent. Again, that's healthiq.com/eliteman. RX Bar is a whole food protein bar that I've been eating like crazy for the past few days. Why? 2 reasons. They are healthy and delicious. I absolutely love these little treats. They're made from 100% whole ingredients, and RX Bar is totally transparent about their ingredients. They cut out all the additives, fillers, and chemicals found in so many other protein bars on the market and stick with the plain but tasty ingredients that make protein bars healthy and delicious. They're gluten-free, soy-free, and dairy-free, and there's no added sugar. In fact, the 3 core ingredients for all RX bars are egg whites, dates, and nuts. And quite honestly, I think they've nailed the healthy and delicious combo to a T. I just got mowing down their chocolate sea salt bar and absolutely loved it. This is one of my favorites. But they've also got 10 other incredible flavors as well, which are equally fantastic. I highly recommend you check these babies out. To get 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/elite and enter the promo code ELITE at checkout. Again, that's rxbar.com/elite and use the ELITE promo code at checkout. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from elitemanmagazine.com, and my guest today is New York Times bestselling author Jay Dobbins. Jay, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me, and welcome to your audience.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. I was just, you know, talking to you a moment ago about our mutual friend Rafa Conde, who was on the show recently. Great dude. You mentioned your name a couple of times and recommended you. And I was already in contact because I wanted to get you on the show before, but it was kind of cool that he had brought you up again as just, you know, an awesome dude that I had to be in contact with. And, you know, really excited to get you on the show, pick your brain, and talk about your book
Actually, you get two books. One is No Angel, which was the first book with the New York Times bestseller, and then you just recently came out with another one called Catching Hell, which is sort of an offshoot as well of that. For those who kind of don't know who J. Dobbins is or maybe what your background is, they probably know the book or may have heard of the book, but maybe not necessarily the background to your story in particular. Can you just kind of fill in some gaps for a minute or two and just talk about sort of what it is you do now and what it is you did when you wrote the book?
Okay, sure. I was a high school and college athlete. You know, as a young man, I thought I had it all figured out. I thought I was going to play in the NFL, you know, and then I realized I wasn't good enough. You know, I had done everything that I was capable of to put myself in the best position for that chance. And I just flat out wasn't good enough. And I was confronted with that that question that many of us are, like, what do I do now? You know, my dreams had crashed. My plans had crashed. And I wanted a job. I wanted to do something that when my alarm clock went off in the morning, I was excited to put my feet on the ground. I wanted to do something. I wanted to make my own dent in the universe. And I was attracted to law enforcement. I wanted to see if I was capable, just try to work undercover. I wanted to see if I was any good at it. And I got a job offer, opportunity, with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And my agency, you know, was and is the leading federal agency for undercover work in the government. At the time, we had a huge undercover program, a lot of expertise, a lot of people, agents that came before me that had done extraordinary things, and I wanted to follow in their footsteps. And so for 27 years, I was an ATF agent, and the bulk of that time was spent in undercover work. I retired 4 years ago, and since then I've written a couple of books. I do some consulting in the entertainment industry with film and television. I do some public speaking. I do some law enforcement training for covert ops, specialty assignment units, gang units, narcotics units, undercover units, their supervision. I coach high school football in the falls, and that keeps me busy. I'm as busy now in retirement as I probably ever was as an agent, to be quite honest with you, and I was a pretty busy agent. So,
what about the job going undercover appealed to you? Yeah. Isn't it sort of like throwing your life away, your identity, you know, who J. Dobbins was as a man before that, and kind of just replacing it with someone completely different when you have to sort of infiltrate something like, you know, Hell's Angels or one of the many other gangs or organizations out there? What about that made you say, yeah, I want to try that?
You know, so much of my life, so much of my professional life translates back to my experiences as an athlete and the lessons I learned as an athlete. And for me, undercover work was a competition. Hmm. It was to see if I was as good as my opponent. It was going toe-to-toe, head-to-head with whoever that adversary was and see who the best man was going to be on that individual conflict, confrontation, battle, whatever you want to call it. I wanted to challenge myself. And that was, you know, the ultimate way to do it for me. It was a very life and death way of testing myself to see how good I was.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense when you look at it that way. It's you know, you got to fill in that sort of missing void when you knew you couldn't be a professional, and you know this was the next best thing. Was it something that were you sort of always on your toes, always sort of paranoid, always like thinking, you know, five steps ahead of like what could happen and playing things out in your head? If like, you know, if this guy has a feeling that I'm, you know, undercover, if he catches on to me, what am I going to do now? What is sort of your mindset going into different situations when you are undercover? Is it like just a constant paranoia that you have to live with?
Well, there's two sides of the paranoia that are train wrecking together. The criminal community is a uniquely paranoid group as a whole. They have to be. That's how they hopefully stay out of jail, stay out of trouble, keep from being arrested, keep from being convicted, is through their paranoia. So everything that you do, everything you say, how you look, how you walk, the clothes you wear, the car you drive, what comes out of your mouth, where you live, those things are all scrutinized by the criminal community to see if you're legit. They're testing you nonstop, constantly examining, like looking for any little crack in your armor. The other side of that is that as an undercover operative, you're also uniquely paranoid. You're paranoid of those same things. You're paranoid of making a mistake, having a slip, presenting something that doesn't fit or that causes your suspect, your target, your adversary to challenge you or to question you. And there's always questions, but you want to avoid the unnecessary questions. You don't want to be confronted with something that you had direct control over and that you could have avoided had you thought yourself through it or had the experience to avoid it.
It's kind of funny you mentioned that as well. Like, it's sort of the, you know, there's two sides to it. Like, if you're a criminal, these guys are always paranoid. They're always thinking, you know, what do I have to do to stay under the heat, under the radar? You know, always not trusting people, thinking someone's going to snitch them out, thinking cops are, you know, that guy's a cop, you know, watching him or whatever, just walking by, or thinking someone's going to kill them when they're walking down the street. It's definitely a crazy sort of mindset, a crazy way to live, go through life living that way. But it seems like there is an appeal to that. I don't know, you know, where it comes from, but some people either head that way or they kind of head the way you head, where it's like the opposite, where like you're a good guy, but you still have that sort of desire to live that sort of life of being on the edge. Is that something you were sort of ingrained with, or is it kind of that competition thing that, you know, maybe these guys have the same sort of competition gene that you do and they're just kind of displaying it to the world in a different way?
You know, I think anybody that's good at undercover work, that they have an ego. Mm-hmm. That they want the pressure on them. They want to be the center of attention. They want to have that operation resting on their shoulders. You know, it's like, again, translating it to sports, you know, it's like a baseball player. When there's two outs in the bottom of the ninth in the World Series,
you
want to be that shortstop who's saying to himself, hit the ball to me. Let me make the play. Let me be the hero. You don't want to be that shortstop saying, I hope they hit it to anybody but me. Please don't put me on the point. If you have that personality trait where you're trying to avoid the conflict, avoid the pressure, avoid the attention, then you might be a perfectly effective law enforcement officer. You might be fabulous in any number of the other trade crafts within the business, but you're probably not the right guy to be working undercover because you have to crave that pressure of having it rest on your shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like I had Andrew Marr on the show a while back, a few months ago, and he's a Green Beret, decorated Green Beret, and he said same thing, kind of Green Berets, Navy SEALs, those type of guys, they all kind of have like a bit of an ego, and that's really what, you know, drives them into being so successful in that department. It's just like they want to be the guy who saves people's lives. They want to put their own life in danger and at risk to display their courage and that kind of thing.
But you know what, I think that translates, it translates beyond you know, our war fighters or lawmen. It translates into competitive business. If you run a business, or if you're, you know, if you're the CEO of a corporation, you want that pressure. You want the pressure on you to make your company perform, to compete. If you're the head of a household, you want the pressure on you to keep things together, to provide for your family, to make things work for your loved ones and for the people that live under your roof. It's not unique to those life and death type professions. It's universal for people with that personality trait.
Yeah, I agree. I think I sort of have that trait as well.
Yeah. You know, it can be a blessing and it can be a curse.
Mm-hmm.
The blessing is that it drives you to the highest levels of achievement that you're capable of. The curse is that you're constantly putting yourself in a position for potential failure. And you don't always win. You don't win every day. You don't win every time. And then that other aspect of the personality comes out, that when you don't win, when you fall, when you get knocked down, what do you do about it? How do you respond to that? Do you get back up and get back in the fight, or do you call time out and say, this isn't for me? Everybody's different.
Mm-hmm. Jay, what is the – I mean, you said you were in the ATF, I think, for 27 years. Out of the 27 years, I think you were undercover in the Hell's Angels operation for about 2 years. What did the rest of the time consist of? Was it just various undercover operations, various stings, kind of low-level drug dealers and stuff like that? Or was there some other type of thing?
Well, you know, to be quite honest, the Hells Angels infiltration is the operation that I worked on that gained the most publicity. It got the most attention. Mm-hmm. It probably doesn't make the top five, maybe the top 10 investigations that I had a direct hand in as an undercover operative, to be quite honest. Wow. What made that case glamorous or sexy in the eyes of the public, at least, wasn't necessarily what I did. It was who it was done on. You know, the Hells Angels, they're a part of Americana. They are, you know, they're America's crime export, organized crime export to the world. You know, mafias and organized crime come to the United States because there's money to be made here and there's opportunity for them. We, the United States, we exported the outlaw biker culture to Europe and to all these other countries that started here. When you ask someone that might not be knowledgeable of that culture or of that world, what do you think of when you think of a biker? They're going to describe the Hells Angels because that's what pops into people's minds. So that case got so much attention because who it was done on. If I would have ran that exact same case on any number of other criminal organizations, it probably wouldn't have gotten the attention. It was on the Hells Angels. Oh, my goodness. Like, these guys were not able to be infiltrated. It had never been done before in their 55-year history. Other people had tried and failed. There was this glamour behind it. But to be honest with you, that wasn't even my best work or my best case.
So you were the first guy to infiltrate the Hells Angels, that's right?
Yes, sir. The first person to become a full member of the gang.
I do want to sort of dive more into this because, like you said, it is sort of the sexier one, the biggest name. And I think there is sort of a fascination with the Hells Angels and other biker gangs like it, you know, the Outlaws, you know, some of the other ones out there. I can't really think of them right now. But there are a number of other gangs, you know, biker gangs throughout the United States and some deadly ones, too. I think there's actually – I forget the name of it. Forgetting the name of it, but they're actually, I guess, supposedly more deadly than the Hells Angels, or they commit more murders per year than the Hells Angels.
Well, you look at you know, what's typically in that world classified as the Big Four, which are the Hells Angels, which are dominant on the West Coast, but they're spread everywhere. You have the Pagans on the East Coast. You have the Outlaws in the Midwest and in the South. And then you have the Bandidos, which are like Arizona or Texas, New Mexico, up through Canada. Now, they've all spread internationally. Mm-hmm. And then outside those Big Four, you have literally dozens of other dangerous organized crime groups. You have like the Mongols motorcycle gang in California. You have the Sons of Silence. You have all these other outlaw motorcycle gangs. But there's really acknowledged as four primary big gangs, and the Hells Angels are the king of that mountain.
How organized are the Hells Angels and some of the other big three, I guess, other gangs out there? Like, how – you said they're international now, which I've heard of. Is it like the Mafia? Is it that organized where they have things just happening behind the scenes all the time, and they have this sort of hierarchy of bosses and people kind of running the show?
It's interesting that you compare them to the Mafia, like to traditional organized crime, mm-hmm. to the Italian-Sicilian mob, is because biker gangs actually went to school on traditional organized crime. And they learned and patterned themselves after that to some extent. There's a hierarchy in these gangs. There's insulation from the leadership all the way down to the soldiers on the street. They have learned to be less observable, less out there, less in your face. A lot of what's going on with them goes on behind the scenes, just like the mob does. You know, you could be sitting at dinner and the table next to you could be a full-blown mafia organized crime member. You wouldn't know it. You could be doing the same thing with one of these biker gang members, and they've learned to conceal themselves. They've learned to hide in plain sight.
Is it as violent? Is it as deadly? Is it, I mean, are they running drugs? Are they running guns? All that stuff like you'd see in, say, like Sons of Anarchy. I know they sort of mimic one of those, you know, Hell's Angels or one of the other major gangs. Is it like that? Is it as sort of prevalent and, I guess, organized in that sense?
From my experience, any level of crime and violent crime that you can imagine was present, from murder to rape to gun running to drug dealing to trafficking of narcotics and firearms, extortion, prostitution, human trafficking, assaults, you name it, it's there. The common theme amongst all that is that if there is an opportunity to make money, they're going to get in it. That's what they're about. They're about hate and money.
Are they about riding motorcycles anymore, or is that just sort of a background thing?
Yeah, I you know, that is ultimately probably their common bond. Mm-hmm. That's ultimately the core of their brotherhood and their friendships, are that they universally are attracted into that culture, into that motorcycle riding. That they do a great job of promoting it. They have a great propaganda machine, which basically says, we're not bad guys. We're not criminals. We're just these fun-loving rascals who like to ride motorcycles, and we don't want to live by society's rules. We want to live by our own rules. To the uneducated public, that's kind of intoxicating. That sounds kind of cool, mm-hmm. right? But it's never that simple. It's never that innocent. As much as they try to sell us that it is, it's never that innocent.
What was the preparation like to before you infiltrated the Hells Angels for 2 years? How much did you have to study? How much did you have to sort of step into this role? How much did you have to pretend to be this, you know, new guy before you actually went on? Was it like months of work? Was it years? Can you talk about that for a moment?
It was, you know, it was for me, it was a professional lifetime, 15 years of undercover work before I took that case on. Probably not a moment before I accepted that assignment was I ready for it. And I'm not even sure I was ready for it when I did accept it, to be quite honest with you.
Wow.
You know, I had, like anybody in any new job, I had started slow, trial by fire. I had been out doing, you know, as a young agent, street buys, small hand-to-hand narcotics deals, one-on-one transactions. But prior to the Hells Angels infiltration, I had, you know, I had done other infiltrations. I had worked on traditional organized crime cases. I had infiltrated home invasion crews. I had done murder for hire investigations, large scale drug trafficking, large scale gun and bomb cases. So I was as well prepared as anybody could be as a lawman to take on that assignment. But with that said, there was people in my own organization who I believe would have been better in the role I played than I played, because I wasn't familiar or comfortable with that outlaw biker gang culture, the mentality. So I learned that on the fly a little bit.
Do you still believe that, looking back now, that those guys would have did a better job, or did you just believe that at the time?
I believed it then, and I believe it now. I know that there's partners, peers of mine, who had worked those types of cases and worked them for years prior to that and worked them successfully and were very comfortable in that world. I wasn't an expert motorcycle rider. I didn't know a whole lot about motorcycles. I didn't know all about the protocols and bylaws and all the rules that exist in that world. And rather than try to fake it and pretend that I was an expert in that world, I just went forward with the attitude that I'm not. Teach me. Teach, like, show me what I'm supposed to know. Teach me how I'm supposed to act. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't really that big of an undercover scam. I was being honest. I was being truthful with them. I don't really understand how all this works, you guys. Show me. Show me what to do. Tell me what to say. Show me how to act.
That's pretty cool. It makes a lot of sense and seems it'd be a lot more effective than, you know, trying to play this part that you can't really fill. But
one of the worst mistakes you can make as an undercover operative is pretending to be something that you're not. Because if I can't sell it, if I personally don't believe it in my head and in my heart, how am I going to make you believe it? I have to believe the persona that I'm portraying. I have to be comfortable and confident in myself. So my comfort and confidence level came from a position of saying, I am not an expert biker. I don't have years and years of experience riding motorcycles and riding in packs and surviving and thriving in this environment. Like, I'm here to learn. I made myself attractive to them, and they embraced me and recruited me in because of some of these outside elements that I was more comfortable in. I played myself off to be a debt collector. I played myself off to be a gun runner. I played myself off to be a quasi hitman. Those were all personas that I had used previously and that I was comfortable with. So I used those from the base of my credibility and then went forward with them and basically said, teach me everything else.
When you say quasi hitman, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I had worked on multiple murder for hire cases where information would come into law enforcement that someone wants someone else murdered. And then we would, through any number of tricks or mechanisms, get in the middle of that. And then I would play the role of a hitman. And I would, for example, if you wanted someone killed, I would meet with you and I would have those conversations with you and I would set that up and then leave you and then lead you to believe that I had killed your victim and then come back to you for payment or compensation. That was something that I had done many times before, and I was comfortable in that role presenting that to the Hells Angels. And I had done it enough and done it successfully enough that when I did present it, they believed it.
So what happened to the people that were supposed to be dead? Would they just kind of like disappear under the radar too, maybe go into some witness protection type of thing?
It's when those murder for hire cases, when one of those drops in your lap, it's the clock comes to a standstill, and at the same time, it's racing. It's like everything you're doing has to stop. You're literally playing God with someone's life when you're put in a position to be the person selected to go murder someone. So everything you're doing, your personal life, your professional life, anything else that's happening comes to a stop, and you have to focus on that. But at the same time, the minute hand on the clock is spinning so fast because the clock is ticking. You have someone's life in your hands. So, you know, typically we would approach the victim and tell them, man, you know what? Someone out there wants you dead. But today's your lucky day because the person that they've hired to kill you is a cop. So cooperate with us. Help us catch this person that wants you dead. Man, 99 times out of 100, that person's going to say, yeah, what do you need me to do?
All right. And then you would sort of help them go under the radar after that and sort of disappear.
Yeah. And to the extent of, taking our alleged victim and dressing them up and making them look dead through makeup and through artistry and through scene creation, and then taking that fabricated evidence of a murder back to the solicitor, back to the suspect, saying, hey, here you go. Here's evidence that this person you want's dead. Pay me. I had done that many times before, and we actually did it within the Hells Angels case. And the event, the murder scam that we ran on the Hells Angels ultimately is what put us over the top, where they put their vests on our back and said, man, you guys got what it takes. You took care of business. You've shown that you're worthy of membership in this gang. Welcome.
Wow, that's pretty intense. So what happened? How did you actually start like to infiltrate? What was like sort of the first day? Was it uneventful, or was it kind of like, you know, walking up to the club leader or whatever they're called, the president of the chapter? Was it like doing something crazy on the first day with them, or was it just kind of like a slow process of sort of building that trust up?
Well, you know what you don't do with these guys is knock on the clubhouse door and say, hello, fellas. Like, I'm interested in being a member. Where do I fill out my application? It doesn't work that way. You know, it was a slow integration. Through the help of some cooperating individuals, some informants, we actually infiltrated a very small but dangerous biker gang that was based in Mexico. And the Hells Angels infiltration, which was called Operation Black Biscuit, which is described in my book, No Angel, it was actually two infiltrations in one. We infiltrated this smaller gang first, not to work them, not to investigate them criminally, but to use our association with them for credibility in the eyes of the Hells Angels. So now we were part of that world. In the Hells Angels' eyes, we were part of that culture. We'd already been vetted. And then it was a matter of spending time with them, getting to know them. It's a painstaking process at times. It's timely. It takes patience and it takes cleverness. And, you know, when you're, to me, in any undercover assignment, in any at least long-term infiltration type assignment, the most dangerous part of that operation is in the beginning. Later in the case, down the road, 2 years down the road, man, they knew me. They loved me. They trusted me. I had guys that would step in front of a bullet for me. They would step in front of a bullet for Jaybird, right? Because that's who they believed. At the beginning of it, when they don't know you and they don't trust you and their paranoia is up and you haven't gained any loyalty yet, you haven't gained their confidence, that's the most dangerous time.
Did you have to get, like, I know, like, gangs, like the Bloods and Crips do some things like jumping you in or beating you. Was there any sort of, like, crazy initiation like that where they had to do some crazy shit, they kick your ass or something like that?
Well, you know, based on my prior undercover experience coming into that operation, I had come to have a really good understanding of the street and how the street works, right? So knowing that those test drives, those mud checks, potentially were floating out there in the future and to some extent unpredictable. You never knew when or where or what that might be. We went proactive with our plan and we arranged what we called street theaters. We set up ruses, for lack of a better term, skits, where we used other undercover operatives to show the Hells Angels, to let them see me in committing crimes. Mm-hmm. So I would bring a Hells Angel along, right? And he would see me go to a bar and do a gun deal. He'd see me go to a bar and do a drug deal. They'd meet me out on the street and see me, you know, get in a brawl with someone. Or any kind of sketchy criminal act you can think of. In their eyes, what they just saw was a crime. They saw a drug deal, a gun deal, a beating. The reality of it is that the person that was playing the other side of that equation was a cop who had a script. It was all a play. It was all designed so that when they did present me with that test drive, when they did challenge me, it put me in a position to say, dude, really? Like, you're going to test me after what you just saw? After what you've seen time and time and time again? I still got to prove myself to you? Are you crazy?
I didn't even realize that kind of stuff went on. It seems like it's obviously very clever. It seems like you guys would do some, like, WWE acting, though, if you got into, like, a, you know, fight with some guy on the street that was another cop. Was it very realistic, though? Would you actually, like, hit him or kind of?
Well, you know what? I'll tell you what. It had to be realistic. Mm-hmm. And the people that we selected had to be perfect for the role. They had to understand what their assignment was on the other side as an adversary to me. Because if it came off as fake or if it came off as a hustle, it would be counterproductive. It would draw questions. It was meant to answer questions. It was meant to lower the guard of the true suspects, not raise their suspicions. Mm-hmm. So basically what it was, in a nutshell, the way I described it, is inaccurate conclusions from accurate observations. Yeah. We would have let them accurately observe a crime. They inaccurately concluded I was a street thug. That was on them. And it worked. If we did our jobs well, if we did our jobs perfectly, it would work. If we made a mistake, man, you know what? Those are the regrets you don't want to have.
Hey, I just wanted to remind you once more to go to healthiq.com/eliteman and save up to 33% on your life insurance for the upcoming 2018 year. Life insurance is incredibly important for you and your family, and Health IQ is the best in the business when it comes to giving you the best rates and deals. Again, that's healthiq.com/eliteman.
Was there ever a time, though, where you had to actually commit a crime where you weren't kind of setting something up and you were just kind of out with them and, you know, they said do this or take care of that real quick? Was there ever anything that you had to, like, kind of go over the line?
Well, many, many times when you – in the base of your question, the core of your question, do you have to commit a crime? Sure. I was involved in dozens of gun and drug deals. Mm-hmm. There was beatings involved. For one example, I get a call, come to the clubhouse, bring your guns. What's going on? Just do it. No explanation. Show up. And I was sent on a murder mission from Phoenix to Las Vegas to go kill some adversaries. And I was told by the Hell's Angels that were sending me on this job, here's the deal. You're going to show up at this place where these guys are at. When you get there, you're going to kill them. We're going to follow you. If you don't kill them, we're going to kill you. So I'm caught in the middle. I'm caught in this sandwich, right?
Yeah.
Now, in the, you know, luckily for me, in the trip between Phoenix and Las Vegas, I was able to contact some law enforcement officers and make sure that my targets, the people I was being sent to get into this gunfight with, never showed up. So we got ahead of the game. The cops in Las Vegas held these guys up. I show up where I'm supposed to be. I've got Hell's Angels watching me. All they see is me at that point, at that time and place, ready to take care of business, ready to handle business. I can't control if the bad guys show up or not. So I come home to a hero's welcome. They didn't know that I circumvented their whole plan from behind the scenes.
What would have happened if the if you couldn't get a hold of the guys and the guys were there? Would you just call the whole operation off?
You know, that was – you know, I've asked myself that question, and I've been asked it many times. What happens if your plan doesn't work out? What happens if these guys are there and you're being watched and you're put on the point? Well, you know, there's certain things that you can and cannot do as a law enforcement officer and as an undercover agent. You're not going to kill someone to stay in role. Just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about that. I'd ran through that potential scenario in my head. Like, if this blows up, if it's not what I think it is, what's my reaction going to be? And the best conclusion I had is that I was just going to fire some rounds into the dirt. I was going to fire some shots into the ground. I'm a pretty good shot. I was going to intentionally miss. And then at that point, they wouldn't have the people watching me would not have been able to be angry with me as far as not trying. Like, I would have just had an excuse like I'm a terrible shot. I'm sorry. I tried. What do you want me to do? I missed. Would that have been good enough? I'm glad I didn't have to find out.
Yeah. Oh, shit. That is definitely a hairy situation to be in if, you know, if that kind of unfolded. But, yeah, what are some of the other skills, you know, mental skills, emotional skills that you've had to develop over the years to be effective in this role? What is the training like to be a successful undercover officer? Is it sort of like, you know, a psychology thing? Is it like a, you know, developmental thing? Is it more of like, you know, just kind of being street smart? What are some of the, you know, operative skills you must have?
Yeah, I think you definitely, like, what comes first or second or third or fifth, I don't know. I know you have to be street smart. You have to understand how the street works and how people that survive and live in that environment, how they think and how they operate. You have to at least understand it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to be able to at least mimic it and make yourself believable. You have to be mentally and emotionally very rugged because lots of things happen and you see lots of things that like no one should have to see. You experience a lot of things that no one should have to experience. You have to be physically tough. It's just physically the wear and tear of doing that job. Sometimes 15, 18 hours a day, day after day, month after month, surrounded by people who, for the moment, love you and will embrace you. But if they find out that you're not who you say you are, they'll put a straight razor to your throat. Living with that, you know, walking on that straight razor for months and years, it's tough. And to be quite honest with you, I'm not proud of this. I'm humiliated by it at times. I'm ashamed of it, but I lost sight of who I was for a point during this case. The case, I was so deep in this case that being an undercover agent, playing this role, turned from being what I did for a living to who I was. And when that happens, man, that's dangerous. That's a really dangerous place to be mentally and emotionally for a lawman, and it does huge battle damage on families and on relationships.
Yeah, I can only imagine how tough it is not to have to step in that role and, like, truly live it, not just act it. Like, you know, you think of guys like Heath Ledger who stepped into that Joker role and, you know, they'd say it kind of pushed him over the edge and he was living that role of, you know, being a crazy guy and, you know, started doing drugs or whatever, so not sleeping and all that other stuff. I can only imagine how tough it is for an undercover agent to not bring that home with them every single night. How did you unwind? How did you just leave that? Yeah, I mean, because you obviously were able to get past it. I mean, you're alive today. You're healthy today. You know, it seems like everything else is going well in your life. How did you kind of survive not being enthralled by the whole lifestyle?
Well, to back up a little bit, like you used like your actor analogy of what happened to Heath Ledger and ultimately his, you know, very unfortunate downfall and demise, right? He's playing a role. He's playing a fictional character for the course of 6 weeks over a filming schedule. You know, when you're an undercover operator, you're playing a fictional persona for months and years at times. It saturates who you are. It becomes who you are. I've done a lot of consulting in the entertainment industry. And I tell the actors I've worked with who've been playing cop characters, playing undercover roles, the difference between what I did for a living and the person you're portraying on the film is that I don't have fake squibs mounted on me. I don't have plastic guns. I don't get to blow a line and say, time out, let me try that again. I don't like the way that sounded. I have to get it right the first time because people are going to point real guns at you with real bullets and there'll be real blood and there's no do-overs. And so, you know, for me, spending that long in an undercover role, in essence, my entire career was in these assignments, and there was never very much time in between. The Hell's Angels case, a day-to-day 12, 15, 18-hour grind for 2 years, you know, weeks and weeks away from home. You know, I would come home, and I would still be acting like I acted on the street. And my wife would say, man, you don't get to walk in the door here and treat us like you're like one of your suspects. And then my reaction, my self-defense, self-protection reaction was, I'm not a light switch. I can't turn this on and off. People that do what I do for a living, that treat it like a hobby, end up dead. I have to be all in. I'm not a light switch. And then her reaction in this family argument was like, well, you better install a damn dimmer switch and turn that down when you come home. Because that ain't flying here.
How did it affect your marriage and your family life? Was there a lot of struggle or stress during that time?
Brutal. Brutal. Because my family was trying to support me for many reasons, the right reasons, for the greater good reasons. Right? But they were trying to support me on a personal level because they knew I loved it. They knew I loved what I was doing. I was passionate about it. You know, I was excited to go to work every day. Even on the bad days, I was excited to go to work. And part of the humiliating element of this story is that, to be quite honest, I don't take any pride in this. I don't like telling this story to people I don't know, is that there was a point in time where I abandoned my family in exchange for my work on the investigation. Man, that's a shameful thing to say about yourself. It's an embarrassing thing to say about yourself. But I did. I own it. I don't make excuses for it. I don't blame anybody else. I made my choices. And I've spent, you know, every day since trying to recover from it.
Was it during those Angels investigation in particular that you sort of think you abandoned the family, or was it just maybe towards like the tail end of your 10-year?
You know, as an undercover operative, when you are presented with the break-even choice of being with your family or being at home versus being with murderers and rapists and drug dealers and gun runners out on the street, and you choose the street, that's not good.
Yeah.
And I was doing that time and time and time again. And not for the wrong reasons. I felt that like every minute, every second that I was outside the presence of the suspects, I was missing something. I was going to miss observing, hearing, seeing, doing something that was going to make our case better. But I had brainwashed myself, you know. My brain had been hijacked by this hero syndrome I had created for myself. I felt like I was out there like doing something important. I felt like I was keeping people safe. I was changing the world. You know, I was doing a job that no one else wanted to or no one else could do. I had convinced myself that that was the truth. The truth is that I wasn't even paying attention to what was going on at my own house. I was trying to save everybody else, and my own family was dying.
So how did you pull yourself back and like save your family and save your marriage and, you know, that life, the more important life of, you know, who you really are?
Well, you know what? I can't take any credit for that. I would love to pat myself on the back and say, hey, let me tell everybody what a good guy I am. Let me tell everybody, like, just like ultimately how moral and ethical I am and what great dignity I have that I fixed all this. The truth is that when I gave up on my family, they never gave up on me. They kept fighting for me after I gave up on them. They had hope for me when I didn't have hope for myself. And they didn't quit. They didn't walk. You know, I've said it many times. I gave my family and my wife a million reasons to kick me out and lock the door, and they gave me a million second chances.
Wow. Sounds like you're a really lucky man.
Blessed. Blessed to have their understanding and their patience and their love and all those things that ultimately allowed us to survive. And not survive because of me, but to survive in spite of me.
So are you happier now that you're out of the ATF and out of law enforcement, out of doing these, you know, crazy, heart-pounding undercover operations, or do you miss that sort of stuff? Do you kind of miss, you know, going out there and putting your life on the line?
I'm happy in the aspect that I didn't leave anything on the table. I did everything I could every day, as hard as I could. Until I didn't have anything left every day. So I didn't leave anything on the table, in my view, unaccomplished as far as my profession as a lawman. What I do miss, I miss in retirement, is I miss the camaraderie of working together on a unit, working with your team, showing up every day with people who have a common goal. You know, my success wasn't ultimately because Jay Dobbins was such a good undercover agent. My success was that I was smart enough to surround myself with really, really good partners.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of people, when they look back on their career or their life, it always seems like the camaraderie, the friendship, the bond they have with a lot of other important men in their life, or even, you know, just women, I guess, if you know, working around women, just the partners and friendships they've made over the year. That seems to be the most important thing, or one of the things that really sticks out. I think there is something to that connection, is, you know, human beings, that's really what we crave for.
Yeah, the human factor is huge. I've always found, I've worked on cases that have been large task force operations. I've worked on smaller cases where they were more individualized. I always got more satisfaction out of the group type cases, where when you succeed, you can share it with people. I always had more satisfaction, more joy, more pleasure out of the group success than I ever did out of anything that was attributed to me, or me alone at least.
Yeah, I think it's one of the tough things too of being like an entrepreneur. A lot of these guys, a lot of listeners to the show, you know, struggle with that at times. It's like, you know, always being by yourself and kind of working on projects or websites or whatever it is by yourself. And it's like you kind of miss that aspect of bonding and connecting and sharing something with other people. But especially, you know, the more that we go into like the 21st century digital age, it's like we're getting more and more away from that ability to fulfill our, you know, need to be connected.
As an undercover operative, there's absolutely times where you're on your own. It's you, and you have to figure it out. You're the one there. You're the one present. You're in the moment. You're living it. You have to go forward on your own. But like personally, I was always better collectively. I was always better when I was able to run ideas, questions, get other people's opinions, and tap into their expertise to help me. I was always better when I had other people around me.
Jay, just a few more questions, man, then I want to sort of wrap things up. It's been a really fascinating interview, though. I appreciate it. What is, like, one of the craziest stories going back to, like, the Hell's Angel? Maybe another case, but I think the Hell's Angel is sort of the most fascinating to me and, you know, probably most of the listeners. What is one of the craziest stories or things you had to do that you can recall right now that just sort of, like, sticks out as something you might want to share?
There was a case I worked pre-Hell's Angels. It's described in my second book. It's described in the Catching Hell book where me and my partner had infiltrated a militia group in, southeast Nevada in the Las Vegas area, and we had been hired to blow up three Las Vegas casinos and create a catastrophe that mimicked the Oklahoma City federal building bombing. To the point where we had live C4 devices built and transferred those to our suspect as part of an operation, as part of a buy bust arrest operation. Over the years, there may be more, and I'm not going to hang my hat on this, but I think it would be hard to find anyone out there who's held with their bare hands in an undercover role more improvised explosive devices than I have, who hasn't been a bomb tech, you know. Over the course of the years, I mean, I literally bought hundreds of homemade, garage-constructed explosive devices. And that's, you know, that's pretty perilous, man, when you're going into some guy's house who's tweaked out on meth, who's trying to make some money by making bombs. You don't know what level of expertise he has, and then he's handing you some device, and you're trusting that it's not going to go off before you can turn it over to the experts. You know, those are rough times.
Yeah, I'd be scared shit to even go, you know, near that thing. Did you deal with, like, terrorist situations at all? Like, potential terrorists, like, creating these bombs and, you know, trying to do, like, where I'm from, Boston, a Boston Marathon bombing or, you know, something that kind of situation?
Well, domestic terrorism situations, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the basis, the core of a lot of these explosive cases that I worked on, the improvised explosive devices cases that I worked on. Everything from, you know, a guy taking a couple pieces of PVC pipe and loading it with smokeless powder and putting a homemade fuse in it and some end caps and selling it as a pipe bomb, to people that built sophisticated electrically activated remote control devices and everything in between. And many of those cases were had a terrorist element to them, because that's the tool of the trade of terrorism. And that's why bombs are so scary, because they're so random. They're unpredictable. When you point a gun at someone, you have relative certainty what your target is and where your bullet's going to go. When you set off a bomb, then you don't know who's going to get hurt or who's going to be around it or when or where it's going to blow.
Do you think that cases of domestic terrorism are increasing, like the prevalence of people making homemade bombs, and, you know, in the next few years, like going forward, is it going to increase, you think, the potential terrorist acts in this country, or is it kind of staying the same or maybe going down?
I'm not an expert in terrorism by any means, but based on my experience, I'd say it's going to increase.
Yeah.
And I think the increase to some extent is due to our access, our electronic access, our access to the internet. You want to figure out how to build a bomb? Man, a couple keystrokes. You know, you want to build a simple bomb? Couple keystrokes. You want to build a sophisticated device? Couple keystrokes. You want to build a suicide jacket? Man, you can figure out how to do it. There's people that are ready to tell you how to do it exactly and make it work.
With that said, is there any way we can kind of protect ourselves? I know it's kind of a general question, but is there any way we can sort of protect ourselves going forward, maybe lower the chances of us being the victims of maybe one of these terrorist attacks?
I think that it's important that all of us as citizens, we're observant. We look for things that when your spidey senses, when your intuition, when your gut tells you, man, that doesn't look right, that doesn't sound right, that doesn't seem right, it probably isn't. We like, those instincts are there to keep us alive. They protect us, right? And so chase that a little bit. And I think, you know, not everybody has this in them, but as any individual out there, when you see something happening that's wrong, that you know is wrong. Do something about it. Do something about it. I'm not saying that you walk up and put yourself in the middle of it. I'm not saying that you go choke out some guy wearing a suicide vest. You know, I'm not saying that you pull your gun or you go get in a fist fight or anything. I'm just saying when you see something wrong, there's a myriad of things you can do to impact it in a positive way. Like on the simplest level, we just go down to the bullying that takes place in society with our kids, right? When you see somebody being bullied, then do something about it. Even when you're a kid, I'm not saying that you walk up to the, you know, in the hallway at your school and punch the bully in the nose to teach him a lesson. I'm saying intervene, you know, confront that guy, confront that bully. How hard is that to just say, man, does that make you feel good? Does that make you feel better to insult somebody, to demean somebody, to humiliate somebody? Does that make you bigger? Does your candle burn brighter because you blow somebody else's out? You know, confront those people and take care of each other.
Yeah, I agree. Jay, do you feel fear for your life now, having done all these undercover operations, having, you know, put all these guys away? I think I read somewhere that it was like 16 indictments for the Hell's Angel case. Is there any kind of worry that you live with from a day-to-day basis today about one of these guys sort of retaliating, kind of, you know, being now that you're in the spotlight and people know who you really are?
Well, beginning in 2004, which was, you know, plus or minus 9 months after the Hell's Angels case ended, I started receiving a series of death and violence threats, spoken, written, some with actions behind them, threats to kidnap my kids, threats to torture my daughter, threats to steal my kids off the school bus, threats to videotape the gang rape of my wife, threats to kill me. There was 3 individual murder contracts being solicited. The Hell's Angels, the Aryan Brotherhood, and the MS-13 were holding sanctioned credible, validated murder contracts on me. There was a threat out there to inject me with the AIDS virus. In the summer of 2008, my home was burned to the ground. And so ultimately, to give you a long answer to a short question, do I live in fear? I don't live in fear. I live with concern. Because if I live in fear, they win. If I let them affect my life, if they let them scare me, drive me underground, hide, they've won, and they haven't had to do anything. I live with concern. I've seen what they're capable of. I know firsthand what they're capable of, the extreme levels of violence that's exists in those worlds, so I know it's there. But I try not to put myself in a bad situation. I don't want a problem. I'm not looking for a problem. I'll do what I can to avoid a problem. But if I get cornered or if I get confronted, you know, I have – God on one shoulder and a pistol on my hip, and together we'll figure it out. I just don't want to have to go. I don't want to have to handle it that way.
Yeah, I think you can, you know, protect yourself as much as you can, and have the gun, and be concerned, and be looking at all times if, you know, something's going to happen. But you're right. You know, living in fear. Same thing with terrorism. You know, the terrorists win if we walk around and, you know, never go out to, you know, New Year's Eve's coming up soon. You know, if Times Square was empty and come New Year's Eve, I mean, they've already won. Like, the game's over. That's, you know, that's it. Like you said, you got to be smart. You got to be concerned about things, but you got to still live your life, you know, fully and as happy as you can with it.
If I let these guys put me in a position where I was going to go hide in a cave and wait for someone to shoot a rocket up my ass, I'd be no better than Osama bin Laden, right? Right? I'm not going to let him do that to me, you know? Mm-hmm. He was fearful. He lived in fear of what was going to be done to him. I'm not going to do that. I don't want a problem. Like I said, man, I've got God on my side and a gun. And if all things, everything else falls apart, I know how to solve the problem. I'll fix it.
I think I came across somewhere that you met Chuck Zito and Sonny Barger, who was the original founder of Hell's Angels. Is that true? And if so, what were those two guys like?
They're both, to be quite honest with you, they're both fascinating, fascinating characters. You know, Sonny found the Hell's Angels. He was a young member. He's definitely responsible for the growth of the gang, the internationalization of the gang, the marketing of the gang, the exposure. Right? I've said many times, based on my personal interaction with him, I think the guy is smart. I think he's charming at times. I think he's funny at times. I think he's intelligent. I think he has business savvy. He has leadership skills. He has all these personal character traits that if he had taken those qualities and used them for good, this guy could have been the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. He, in essence, he is. And his employees are to some extent like street misfits, right? He built a Fortune 500 company from street misfits, right? And then Chuck is just, you know, he was the epitome of flamboyance. He was the example of the pride of the brotherhood and the patch and the name. And he flew that flag and held out his membership and demonstrated that everywhere he went. And that was an example of what that was like, like being a true believer in that gang.
It's very interesting. It's kind of funny that those guys, you know, that you see like the mafia guys and, you know, over the years, John Gotti, those type of guys, Whitey Bulger. But you don't really hear much about like the Hell's Angels leaders or some of these other mafia guys nowadays. But like these two guys in particular are like celebrities. Like Chuck Zito's a celebrity, hangs out with all these Hollywood people. Sonny Barger now is a celebrity. But it's sort of funny how like society has sort of like shifted its perception of them or like, you know, accepted them in a way.
It's the sexiness and the glamour of that piece of Americana. And you look at our culture. We've as a culture, we were fascinated with Jesse James. You know, we were fascinated with Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday. And, you know, and then as time grew, we were fascinated with Al Capone and John Dillinger. And then, you know, through time, we were fascinated with Charles Manson. And then up through organized crime with, you know, the New York families and John Gotti. And it's part of our culture, and it's promoted through the media. It's promoted through like all our senses, like all the television shows. You know, when you look at The Sopranos and Sons of Anarchy, those shows bring us into a world that we normally wouldn't experience. And it's fascinating to us. I watch those shows. I like those shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're both actually really good shows. Jay, it's been an awesome interview again, man. Is there a last sort of send-off, takeaway message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience? I know we could sort of, you know, continue to talk for hours, man, but we got to kind of wrap things up. But is there a last, you know, send-off you'd like to leave, and then a place that you'd like our listeners to check out your books, No Angel and Catching Hell?
Yeah, if you go to my website, it's jaydobbins.com, jaydobyns.com. There's links there for both books. And, you know, my parting message would be that ultimately our jobs, you know, as human beings are try to take care of each other. You're put more to the forefront of that as a lawman. You're put more to the forefront of that as a war fighter. But everyday citizens, we can look out for each other, and we can care about each other, and we can love each other. And when we see something wrong, when you see someone in need, when you see someone in trouble, try to help, try to do something, you know, try to make your own dent in the universe in a positive way.
Jay, thanks again for coming on, brother. Really do appreciate it. It's been a fantastic interview, man. I love chatting with you, and I feel like we could, you know, continue to chat for hours more, but thanks again, man. Really appreciate it. And, take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Right on. Thank you. Happy New Year.
Just a quick reminder to go to rxbar.com/elite to get 25% off these incredible protein bars. Again, that's rxbar.com/elite and use the promo code elite at checkout. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.